He nodded. She nodded back. Does it distress you, reader, how I remind you of their sexes in each sentence? Hers and his? Does it make you see them naked in each other's arms, and fill even this plain scene with wanton sensuality? Linguists will tell you the ancients were less sensitive to gendered language than we are, that we react to it because it's rare, but that in ages that heard he and she in every sentence, they grew stale, as the glimpse of an ankle holds no sensuality when skirts grow short. I don't believe it. I think gendered language was every bit as sensual to our predecessors as it is to us, but they admitted the place of sex in every thought and gesture, while our prudish era, hiding behind the neutered they, pretends that we do not assume any two people who lock eyes may have fornicated in their minds, if not their flesh. You protest. My mind is not as dirty as thine, Mycroft. My distress is at the strangeness of applying he and she to thy 2450s where they have no place. Would that you were right, good reader. Would that he and she and their electric power were unknown in my day. Alas, it is from these very words that the transformation came which I am commanded to describe. So I must use them to describe it. I am sorry, reader. I cannot offer wine without the poison of the alcohol within. Carlyle smiled now. Those are good rules, good precautions. I think he meant the words as praise, but Thisbe gave an irritated kick, nearly catching my nose with her heel under the table. Of course they were good precautions. She was Thisbe Sanir of the Sanir Weeksbooth Bash, custodian since birth of one of the most powerful engines of our civilization. Who is this little cousin to pronounce judgment, good or bad, on her precautions? Then follow them. I will. Carlyle licked his lips, the thousand questions in his mind struggling to choose a vanguard. Where did Bridger come from? She breathed deep. We don't know. They were a toddler when they animated the soldiers. We don't know anything before that. We've been raising them here in secret ever since, and it's going to remain secret until Bridger is mature enough to fully understand the implications of their powers and decide for themselves who, if anyone, to show them to. You've raised them in this bash? In the flower trench outside, she corrected. There are hiding places. Does the rest of your bash know? No. I spoke up. Cato? Right. Thisbe laughed, possibly at herself, or possibly at having a bashmate so harmless she could forget. Cato sort of knows. That's Cato Weeksbooth? I saw the flicker in Carlyle's lenses as he brought up the file. I don't have an appointment with them yet, but I called to make one. Thisbe frowned. Cato doesn't know about Bridger's powers, or the soldiers, or even that Bridger lives here in the trench. But we take Bridger to a kids' science club Cato runs, to meet other children. So Cato knows Bridger as a kid Mycroft and I are mentoring, but nothing more. Mycroft. At last, Carlyle's scrutiny fell fully on me. On my knees beneath the table, I tried again to look as non-threatening as a man could be who had just tackled Carlyle with bestial speed. Should I describe myself here? What Carlyle saw? I am nothing much. Perhaps as tall as Thisbe had I not learned to stoop. My skin a little dark, with dark hair always overgrown, and a thinness to my face which makes some worry that I eat too little. My hands have acquired something of a laborer's roughness, and my servicer uniform of dappled beige and gray hangs on me loose enough to sleep in. On a street, you wouldn't give me a second glance, and even with old photographs before you, you would not know me now without the telltale ear. Mercifully, It was my uniform that caught Carlyle's eye, and I recognized the familiar, judgmental half-step back which free men take around the guilty. Murder for profit is the crime most people think of when they see a servicer's uniform. A crime the convict has no reason to repeat now that the law has stripped him of the right to property. Those with more imagination might envision a grand corporate theft or a revenge killing, avenging some great evil beyond the reach of law, or a crime of passion, catching a lover in a rival's arms and slaying both in a triumphant but passing madness. At the dawn of the 15th century, St. Sir Thomas More described a humane, though fictitious, Persian judicial system in which convicts were not chained in the plague-filled dark, but made slaves of the state, let loose to wander without home or property, to serve at the command of any citizen who needed labor. Knowing what these convicts were, no citizen would give them food or rest except after a day's work, and with nothing to gain or lose, they served the community an ambitionless, lifelong peace. Tell me, when our 22nd century forefathers created the servicer program, offering lifelong community service in lieu of prison for criminals judged harmless enough to walk among the free, were they progressive or retrogressive in implementing a 700-year-old system which had never actually existed? "You've been helping to raise Bridger too?" Carlyle asked. Thisbe answered, "Mycroft stumbled on Bridger much like you did. I admit it's a bit of a fudge putting cleaning services instead of childcare when I log Mycroft's hours, but it's no violation of the spirit of the law." I held my breath for this moment, when Carlyle held my fragile future in his power. He could have reported me, my false work logs, my too close relationship with this Bosch, almost familial, all things forbidden to we who forfeited home, Bosch, and rest when we committed crimes so severe that a lifetime's labor can never balance out what we destroyed. But Carlyle is a kind creature, and smiled even for me. "Nice to meet you, Mycroft. You must have a court-appointed censor?" "Yes, I do." "Who doesn't know about Bridger?" "Correct." "And Thisbe, you've never had a censor who knew?"
"No."
"Then neither of you has ever been able to talk to a censor before about the implications of it?" Thisbe paused.
"I suppose not."
"Would you like to? We do have an appointment, if you're up to it." She gawked.
"You're up to it?"
"Always." I liked Carlyle's always, his firm tone, as if some energy in him were awakened by this whiff of his true calling. "And, Mycroft, if you'd like me to arrange a session for you sometime, I'm sure I could get it cleared."
"I'll consider it," I answered,
crawling my way out between the table's legs and Thisbe's at last. She frowned. "Mycroft, you don't have to leave just because I have a job." It was no lie. A summons from the Mitsubishi Executive Directorate had been buzzing in my ear for some time. I had lingered since Bridger took priority, but now I had a reason of my own to visit Togenkyo. My searches had sliced deep. There were not many gag genes born in precisely 2426, not many parents who would produce a child with eyes that shade of blue, hair edged with that tint of gold, and not many hospitals whose records would not open before the security codes I had the privilege of borrowing. That led me to Togenkyo. Thisbe knows she will not learn about my work by asking. "Will I see you tonight?" She leaned toward me and touched my back, her palm and slow fingers tasting the contours of my flesh. Instantly, I could read it in his face, Carlyle succumbed to the vision of me naked in Thisbe's arms. That was the great service Thisbe did me. Even without lying outright,
The practiced femininity beneath her lazy posture could convince anyone, even the Basib she grew up with, that my constant visits were no more than a mundane, forbidden fling. Carlyle had seen Bridger already, so there was no real need for us to deceive him, but someone who thinks he knows a man's dirty secret will usually stop looking deeper. I returned Thisbe's stroke with my own across her cheek, just as practiced. Hopefully. She leaned close to my ear, trusting our pantomime to make it seem natural. Is this cousin trouble?
I'll know in a few hours, I whispered back. Meanwhile, use the session. Get to know them. Test them.
Thisbe gave a warm, wide smile. I was full of fears as I left, not fears of Carlyle or fears for Carlyle, but fears of what Togenkyo might reveal about who sent Carlyle. Skilled as he was, and perfect for our needs, I could not believe this Gagjin of all the senseis on Earth would be assigned by chance. And I shall bear you with me to Togenkyo, reader, but not yet. First, I must show you what was happening upstairs in this same Bosch house before I was summoned down by Thisbe's cry. I pray your patience. After all, if you choose not to believe in Bridger, then it is upstairs where begins the half of all this that, you will admit, reshaped our world. Chapter the Third. The Most Important People in the World. Another car had touched down that same morning, March the 23rd, before the same Bosch house. Cielo de Pajaros blazes like a glacier on such mornings, white sun reflecting off the long rows of glass roofs which descend toward the Pacific in giant steps like Dante's Purgatory. The city is named for the birds, they say over a million, wild but cultivated, hatched and fed in the flower trenches that separate the tiers, so the flocks constantly splash up out of hiding and fall away again into the trench depths like the wave crests of a flying sea. Cielo de Pajaros is one of Kropotkin's earliest spectacle cities, much criticized for its homogeny, row upon row of homes with no downtown or shopping districts, but it has never lacked for residents. Critics claim that people tolerate living without a downtown in return for Chile's perfect ocean views, or even that residents choose the city largely out of hive pride. Humanist members excited to think the great Sanyo Weeksbooth computers are humming away beneath their boots. But humanists are not the only residents. One finds cousins here, Mitsubishi, clusters of Gordian. I think Cielo de Pajaros is a success because it was the first city designed for those who don't like city centers, whose perfect evening is spent by a window, watching gulls and black waves crashing down. What need is there for bustle in a city built for Bashes who prefer to be alone? Martin Guildbreaker alighted from the car and crossed the gleaming footbridge over the flower trench to ring the main door's bell. What could those inside see as he approached? A square-breasted mason's suit, light marble gray and crisp with that time-consuming perfection only seen in those who perfect their appearances for another's sake, a butler for his master, a bride for her beloved, or Martin for his emperor. A darker armband, black-edged imperial gray with a square and compass on it, declares him a familiaris regni, an intimate of the Masonic throne, who walks the corridors of power at the price of subjecting himself, by law and contract, to the absolute dictum of Caesar's will. Martin wears no strat insignia, not even for a hobby, nothing beyond his one white sleeve announcing permanent participation in that most Masonic rite, the Annus Dialogorum. His hair is black, his skin a healthy, vaguely Persian brown. But I will not bore you with the genetics of a line that has not worn a nation strat insignia these 10 generations.